book ended up being 145,000 words, and I had to cut 40,000 words. It was obscene. Like, it didn't need to be that long, but that was my insecurity. And because I'm a novice still, really, you know, I'm not someone who understands intrinsically how to write books. I still feel like a beginner.
Welcome back to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. And the voice you heard there was that of Bella Mackey, author of three very successful books. 2018's Jog On was her first. It was a memoir of Bella's struggles with severe anxiety and OCD and how discovering running really helped her. And it was a bit of a surprise bestseller. She said the publisher had to quickly order more copies to be printed because they hadn't anticipated how successful it was going to be. She then pivoted to fiction for 2021's How to Kill Your Family, which is a kind of comedy thriller told from the perspective of Grace, who has murdered her billionaire father and all his horrible relatives. The paperback spent almost a year in the bestseller top 10, and it's currently being adapted into a Netflix show starring Anya Taylor-Joy. Bella's second novel, What a Way to Go, was published last month, and it's another funny, twisty tale of unpleasant people getting their comeuppance. I went to Bella's house in August. She shares her house with her husband, Greg James, who you may know from BBC Radio 1, and their dog, Barney, who is also a bit of a celebrity in his own right. And you'll definitely hear him padding around in the background during our interview. I think Bella found it very funny how nervous I was around Barney, who is very enthusiastic, shall we say, but essentially very lovable. If you follow Bella on Instagram, it won't surprise you to hear that the house is very beautiful and colourful. It's in a busy part of North London, so you'll also hear some sirens, but I think that all adds to the atmosphere. We talk about her transition from journalism and non-fiction to writing novels, about structure and how she built suspense, and about the 130,000 words that she wrote after How to Kill Your Family and ended up ditching, and what she learned from that experience. Something I like very much about Bella is that she's self-aware and she's honest. And the day before we recorded this interview, she published a newsletter pointing out that many people in the public eye don't reveal the help that they had in finding success. Bella's father is Alan Rusbridger, who for a long time was the editor of The Guardian. And in this episode, you'll hear her explain some of the luck that she's had along the way. But there's no doubting that she's a very clever, very funny writer. And I'll link to that newsletter in the show notes. Before we get going, a quick message about Curtis Brown Creative, who are kindly sponsoring this season of the podcast. They are the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency, and since launching in 2011, over 240 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including critically acclaimed authors Jenny Godfrey, Jane Harper, and Alex Hay. If you love sinking your teeth into a page-turning thriller and want to try your hand at writing one, join their six-week online Writing a Psychological Thriller course with teaching videos and practical tasks from best-selling author Erin Kelly. Curtis Brown Creative ran a wide variety of writing courses focused on different genres, from romance novels to science fiction, so there's something on offer for every kind of writer. They've provided an exclusive discount for In Writing listeners. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of Writing a Psychological Thriller or any other six-week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. But for now, over to Bella.
So we're in the dining room, which is, you know, your standard fare. It's got a table, it's got chairs, it's got some plants that I'm trying to keep alive. And it looks out into the garden. And I write here because firstly, it's quite cool. Secondly, because it is the one table that is accessible to me to write from. And thirdly, it does mean that the dog will sit at my feet when I'm working. Whereas if I sit anywhere else, he will pester me. But to be honest, it's mainly because I don't have a desk.
Why don't you have a desk?
Someone else asked me this recently and I said, oh, you know, it just feels like a big commitment to buy a desk. For some reason, I don't pull the trigger on it because I think, is this a full-time job? Is this going to be the job I do forever? What if I bought a desk and then I'm not doing it anymore and then I've just got this desk? So, yeah, Greg is always saying to me, get a desk. But then I was the same as a teenager. I remember my mum, you know, when I was revising, would say, you know, we've got to get you a desk. And I'd be sitting on the floor and she'd be like, Miss Bella, you have to have a desk. So eventually she got me a desk and I never used it. So, you know.
Yeah, I suppose maybe you don't need a desk if you're a kitchen table person.
But then on the other hand, you know, I'm 41 and my back is increasingly not the back I had when I was 20.
I think a chair is almost more important than a desk, like a nice ergonomic chair.
Exactly, but they're so hideous.
Yeah, but surely there's a beautiful one somewhere in the world.
But then it will be £5,000. Mm. So you see the problem. If someone could invent a chair that's ergonomic, beautiful and £250, then get in touch.
So if you're not writing here, you write in the living room.
Yeah.
What is it about the living room?
Well, I guess the living room is because I'm sort of, it's, again, it's quiet and I've got a comfortable sofa for my back. And also because I'm surrounded by books in there. So it sort of feels oddly sort of suggestive to me, like thematic.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's a mood shift depending on where you're sitting? Like, are you in here for a certain frame of mind and in there for a cozier frame of mind, maybe?
Yeah, I think if I'm sitting in the dining room, it's because I'm trying to concentrate and knuckle down. That's where I'm going to set my Pomodoro method timer. You know, that's where I'm going to kind of sit down and be like, I'm going to write 200, you know, 200 words, then 200 words, and I'm going to keep going. If I'm in the living room, it's more like, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
So it's a lot more. And then sometimes I'll write on the floor upstairs in the bathroom. And that's a kind of mania of like, I've just got to get this done. I can write anywhere. I'm not, you know, I'm not precious about where I write, and I don't have to have like the exact right setup. I'm not one of those people, which is strange because I sort of like control. So you'd think I'd want, you know, the same space every time, but I can write on my phone if I have to. Mm.
I think there's something as well about not psyching yourself out potentially. If like, I think if you have a room that's specifically for work and you have a desk and you have quiet and all the circumstances are lined up for a perfect writing environment, for some people that really works, but for other people it's like too much pressure.
Yeah, I think, you know, you hear about writers who get you know, they build like sheds at the back of the garden, or you know, they have kind of separate spaces from their households, you know, so that like dogs and kids can't come in, and it's very sort of quiet and contemplative. And I think that must be a huge pressure to walk in there every day and be like, right, gonna start work. Because I just, you know, you've built something, you've spent lots of money, you've done all these things. And then you kind of feel like, if you're having an off day, don't you feel really guilty?
And are you writing something at the moment?
I'm plotting something at the moment.
Okay.
So normally, historically, I'm not a big plotter. Normally I just go into it and then I have to write my way out of the sort of the puddles that I've got myself into because I've not plotted it. So this time around, I'm plotting something properly.
Okay.
I have learned that I need to do that.
Another novel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And will it be of a similar theme, kind of murdery, comedy-ish?
Yeah, I think so. I'm still really enjoying that. And I think to pivot, I mean, I could pivot and write, you know, a sort of searing, you know, fictionalized memoir or something. But I think I'm still really enjoying the kind of fun, crimey, bad people genre that I've been in.
That you do so well.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your routine with writing? I think I've heard you say before that you prefer to write at night. Is that still the case, or was it with this second novel?
No, not so much this second novel, and I think that's probably because I'm older and my husband goes to bed really early, and so I'm going to bed earlier than I used to. I used to think, you know, there was no point in going to bed before 2 a.m. and I think now I'm a bit more like, well, turning in at 11:30 isn't so bad. Because I think that was a side effect of COVID, was, you know, he would go to bed early and then I couldn't go out or see anyone. So I'd just be sat on the sofa for hours on my own. And I think I got that started to get a bit bleak. So I try not to do that now. I still sometimes do though. Sometimes, you know, if I've got a deadline, I'll be writing into the night, and I will be sort of whacking it out and then rereading it in the morning to see if it sort of makes sense. But mainly now I try and write in the afternoons up to the kind of early evening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why does afternoon work for you?
I think I'm just not a huge morning. I've never been a very good morning person. I'm really resentful that the world decided that the morning people were going to be the winners and that the evening people were not. And I don't know when it happened, but it makes me very sad. And, you know, I think I wouldn't be able to do good work at 9 a.m. in the way that I'd be able to do it after I've exercised and had like food, proper food. But in the mornings, I'll reread what I've done.
Okay.
So I'll reread and I'll occasionally edit, and I will make notes about things, but that's more like, you know, prep for the afternoon and going over things. The afternoon is then the writing bit.
I've got loads more questions about the writing stuff, but just want to go back a little bit and talk about kind of career path. So you went to art school, right? Mm-hmm, yeah. And then for a while you were a journalist, mm-hmm. predominantly, and you're from a family of journalists. Do you enjoy that kind of writing, or in retrospect, was it kind of just a stop off to being an author? Was that always the hope?
Well, I wasn't really, I didn't really write as a journalist. I was more editing. So I wasn't, I didn't really, I mean, I wrote occasionally, but it wasn't kind of, I mean, that was not something I was trained in or kind of particularly confident about doing, I guess. And it wasn't a stop off. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, you read the piece I wrote yesterday, which is about kind of privilege and the fact that, you know, people don't acknowledge the starts that they had in life. And I wrote this piece about how, I mean, it was about influencers, but acknowledging that, like, I am the product of, you know, nepotism, leg ups, connections, all of those things. So it's not that I went into journalism with a burning desire to be, I mean, I loved journalism and I'd grown up around journalists, but I think at that point, you know, I wasn't hired to be a journalist anyway. I was hired to be a data inputter and then a moderator. So I didn't do journalism for about 8 years anyway. But I mean, I loved it and I would have gone on doing it, you know, forever. But I mean, I think the winds just changed in journalism a bit, and I was working at Vice by the time I sort of left working full time in journalism, and it was quite a sudden thing of, like, you know, suddenly they had money and then suddenly they didn't have money, and it sort of was a bit like, okay, what are the options here? And it was just, again, another lucky thing that I had, that someone got in touch and said, would you like to write a book? And I'd always wanted to write books, but it just felt like, that felt like a ridiculous childhood ambition, you know, yeah. Like being a ballerina or whatever.
But that was off the back of a piece that you'd written.
Yeah,
is that,
yeah,
right?
I'd written a piece about how running had really helped my mental health, and this guy emailed me, and I thought it was a troll. I thought, like, this doesn't seem like a real thing that someone would do, in a, you know, because I didn't know the book world at all. And I googled his name and nothing came up, and I thought, okay, this is not a real guy. So I didn't reply, and then he emailed again a month later and was like, did you get my email?
That's so funny that you didn't reply.
I know, I just thought, this doesn't seem at all likely, you know. And I hadn't heard of William Collins, you know, which was the imprint. And I just thought, all of this just sounds like someone wants to embarrass me, you know, and sort of set me up to kind of think I'm going to write a book. So, yeah, again, it was just like, you know, it was a childhood dream and not something I thought I'd get. But then, because I'm really lucky, I did get the opportunity. So that's kind of a horrible answer, isn't it? Because it's not even like, and I worked really hard towards the one thing that I always wanted. It's like, I wanted it and then I got it. And that's
but you're also a very good writer. I mean, it's not, well, it didn't come out of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, I was always, English was the only thing I was ever good at, actually. I wasn't good at anything else. I loved art, but I wasn't good at it. And I was told that by my tutors explicitly. But English was the only thing I was ever, you know, going to be any good at. And it's odd because everyone in my family is not, there's no maths, there's no science, you know, there's nothing like that. It's always been English. And so I guess the genes just, they come through in the end.
Yeah. I think, by the way, your sort of understanding of the journalism world and your maybe kind of affection or maybe kind of scorn for some elements of it really comes through in a really funny way in the new novel, because there's some really funny satirical, yeah, magazine articles or online articles that are just so spot on and well observed. And yeah, you can feel that you understand that sort of language of journalism so deeply. So you got the deal to write Jog On, and you wrote it, and it sold out its print run. It was kind of unexpectedly successful, wildly successful, and it was a memoir of your experiences of OCD and anxiety, but also running and how it, you know, helped you manage those things. That must have been quite exposing, and I have spoken to quite a few people who've written memoirs who've said it's that kind of attention on something so personal when it comes out, particularly if it's successful, is very intense. What was your experience of that like, and do you think you would write another memoir having been through that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when people now write those kind of books, if I know them or I know of them, I will always message them to say, like, set your boundaries. And that's kind of a gross phrase, but I mean, decide how much you're willing to kind of have people send you their stories and their own experiences. Because, you know, if there's things that you've written about that are really difficult and tricky, people are going to want to tell you about their own experiences. And that can be really difficult. And I didn't expect that, because I didn't think that a lot of people would buy the book. Sorry, there is a dog moving. Funny, settle. And yeah, so lots of people got in touch with me and said, you know, this is exactly how I felt, this is my story as well, and then would tell me things and ask advice. And obviously you can't give advice because, you know, you're not a professional. But I did feel an incredibly like strong sense of duty to reply to everyone. So I replied to all of them within the first kind of month. And my husband and my mum were saying, don't do this. You know, it's really bad for you. And I was saying, no, it's fine. You know, I can do this. Because it did feel like there was some kind of quid pro quo of like, you know, I've written the book, you've bought the book, and now you get to tell me your version of events, of your life. And I do think that's tricky. I mean, you know, it made me very anxious for about a month. And then it subsided. And now people still message me about mental health. And I find it great. I find it interesting. And, you know, I'm honoured that people do it. But I am more reserved, I think, when it comes to kind of going into a back and forth with someone about their mental health. Because I think it's something obviously I can't actually help them with. But also, you know, if someone tells you kind of the most traumatic things that's, you know, they've experienced, that can be quite tricky if you're not a professional and you don't know how to cope with it.
I think it's something that happens so much when you're writing and your name is sort of out in the world, even as a journalist. I've found that there is a feeling sometimes that people know you or feel they know you, and that is quite difficult to navigate because you're grateful for it and you appreciate it and it's nice, and it's a sign that your work is sort of resonating, but it's also can feel quite intrusive. And sometimes, yeah, you can have messages from people who want something from you that you can't really give them. And yeah, it's a difficult line.
I guess that's, you know, that's the modern world, isn't it? Because if you'd been a journalist or a writer 50 years ago, this wouldn't have happened. You know, you might have got letters coming into the office, you know, for you, but they could be intercepted and, you know, thrown away or whatever. Or you'd have read them and you wouldn't feel that you had to reply. But it's the internet, isn't it? It's the kind of parasocialness of liking something that someone's written and then going to find them on Instagram or Twitter or whatever it is, and then feeling like you can have a connection with them. I mean, it's the same, I guess, with newspapers sort of opening up comments on the internet, which is this kind of readers now feel like they have a right to also have their say in a way that they wouldn't have had in years past. And that kind of, we're still quite new into that, I think. You know, that's still, I don't think we've really understood where those boundaries are and what is appropriate and what's not.
Mm-hmm. So would you think about writing another memoir if you had material for it, or do you feel like having done that once, that might be enough?
Well, when I was writing it, I remember my editor said to me, your life is not that interesting for it to just be a book about your life, you know, which is why there was a lot of kind of research and, you know, facts and a lot of other personal accounts from other people. I thought that was really good advice, that I'm like, you know, at the time I was 31, 32 writing it, like a middle class, nice, you know, sheltered girl from London. Like, you know, how interesting is that on its own? So I think probably not, you know, unless I decide to kind of join the circus or, you know, adopt a, you know, pygmy goat farm or, you know, I just think, you know, you can fall in love with writing personal self-confessional pieces. And there's such a huge demand for it that, you know, I think you can end up exposing parts of your life that maybe you shouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly done that as a journalist, not in the last few years because I sort of stopped.
No, me too. No. Me too. And I think it's really seductive and flattering that people say, you know, we'd love to hear about your dating life or, you know, your, you know, fertility or whatever it is. And you think, okay, and then it's, you know, interesting to write because you're interested in your own life. But then it's out in the world, and again it's that thing that people think they know you from that, and that's quite exposing.
Yeah,
you know, there's no aftercare for something like that.
No, God. So what was the transition to fiction like, having done that? How many years between?
It was three years between
Jog On and How to Kill Your Family.
Yeah. That was another kind of amazing bit of fortune for me, because Jog On did well, and they were, you know, the publisher was saying, well, maybe you'd like to write another book about, you know, I don't know, trampolining your way out of sadness, or, you know, baking your way out of the blues. You know, there were kind of constant themes of, you know, what's similar to Jog On. And I just thought, I don't want to do that. I don't want to write another nonfiction book like that. And also it wouldn't be authentic, because running is the thing. I'd have to take something else up. So I said, oh, I'm going to try and write a pitch about a book. And I remember my agent being like, And obviously William Collins and nonfiction, so they were like, they were out. And he took it to like two or three publishers who said no. And I thought, oh, crap, this isn't going to work. And then Burra came along and said, okay, yeah, we'll take it.
And that was based on what the...
I'd written 3-4 chapters, so okay. About 50,000 words.
Okay.
And obviously, you know, my agent was like, if you write the whole thing, you get a better advance. And, you know, and, but I was thinking, no, I need money to write the book. I need you to pay me to do it because I've left my full-time job now and I need you to pay me up front. So that was what happened. And then, yeah, I remember sitting down and thinking, I don't know how to do this because, you know, the whole thing about journalism and nonfiction is that you have to get your facts right. You have to, you know, rigorously be kind of constantly checking that everything you've said is the truth. And then suddenly you're sat there with a blank page and you're allowed to do whatever you want, you know, and it feels amazing and weird because you're thinking, I can just make it up, you know, because that goes against everything that you know, which is, you know, making something up is the worst thing you can do. So that was quite an odd switch. But then I thought, this is the best fun because you can do all of that. And I, you know, I was thinking, is it weird if, you know, if someone dies in a locked sauna? And then I was thinking, I can make it up, you know, it doesn't have to be realistic. This is not what that book is. So it was incredibly freeing. I think now, you know, a few years in, I think, oh, Christ, you know, the same thing I love is the same thing that daunts me, which is that it has to come from my brain. You know, I can't look and you can research to a point, but ultimately it has to come from your head and only your head, no one else's head. You know, there's no collaboration. There's no kind of, you know, someone to hold your hand throughout. So, yeah, it's kind of it's a weird, complex kind of two-headed thing.
Had you been writing stories all along? Was it something... No, you were doing as a hobby? Or?
No, I wasn't. I had lots of ideas for books that I'd written down for years. I'd come up with things and I'd think that could be a novel. And then I'd look back at the notes and be like, oh no, that couldn't be a novel. What are you talking about? That's ridiculous. And there are still some I have actually in my phone notes where I think that could be a novel. In fact, I emailed myself one yesterday and I was talking to Greg about something on a walk the other day saying, I was asking him a question about buried treasure. And he was like, oh God, is this? And I was like, yeah, it's just, I think it's a really good idea. And he was like, okay. So I had lots of ideas, but I wouldn't have had the confidence to write something. And it was only that because that book had done well that I thought, this is my opportunity. If I'm going to do it, this is the time someone's going to let me, you know?
Yeah.
Because you are, I think in publishing, you're only as important as your last book.
Yeah.
So, you know, if the next one flops, they're not going to be letting me write, you know, whatever I want for the third.
I don't know, when I interviewed Jeff Dyer, he said that he felt he'd maintained a really good career by publishing books that were sort of middlingly successful. So he said that he's, you know, he's always managed to get, well, he sold a lot of books, but he claims that they've never been successful enough, that there's been much interference in what he wants to write or, you know, I mean, whether this is accurate or not, I don't know, but this is Jeff Dyer's theory.
That's interesting, isn't it? Just you have a very solid career. You sell enough books that, you know, you've got a fan base, people like you, you're sort of moderately successful, which means that you never crash and burn. And also that your publishers are like, well, you're doing it fine. This is fine. You can do what you want. Rather than being like, Bella, why have you written this? This is not the book you're supposed to write. This is dreadful, which happened with this book.
What? What do you mean?
I was really unhappy throughout COVID, really anxious, you know, really, really bad in a sort of pit. And I started writing this book and I had, so there were two things going on. The first was I was really unhappy. And the second one was, well, I can't write anything like How to Kill Your Family because, you know, it won't be as good and people won't buy it and it'll be, you know, and then I'll just be pigeonholed and it'll be a nightmare. And I thought, I have to write something serious. That'll be what I do. I'm going to write something serious and show that I'm, you know, I've written Jog On and then I've written something funny and now I can write something serious and that I've, you know, get you a girl that can do all of them. And I just, you know, ridiculous. So I started writing a book and powered on to the end, 130,000 words. And because I was unhappy, it wasn't funny. And also I was trying to make it serious. And then my editor was kind of, I could see that she was trying to massage it into the shape that she felt it wasn't in. I knew it wasn't in the right shape. Both of us were kind of trying to do things to it, overwriting, writing back in, you know, you write your way out into a problem and then back, you know, it's all of that. And then eventually we met with her boss, who was the head of fiction. And she said, I've read it. This is two books in one. Which book do you want it to be? And so I said, this book? And she said, right, that's okay. So then you have to strip back all the other parts and see what happens. So I did, and it still didn't work. And then she was fantastic, actually. It was so clarifying to hear someone just be like, this doesn't work. Because actually, me and my editor were just too deep in it to be able to do that. We were just kind of, we were like, there must be a way. And actually, it was much, much kinder to just say, this has not worked. And then I just delete the whole thing and start again.
So that book completely...
It's gone. I mean, it's not gone. It's on a Google Doc. Nothing's ever gone, is it? But...
You don't think you'll go back and
I've reread bits of it and like body cringed at how kind of sad and serious it is, and how I've tried to write like a sort of... It reads to me like a kind of 16-year-old's attempt to be like deep.
Oh. Yeah. That's how I felt when I've tried to write fiction as well.
Yeah. I think it's that self-conscious thing of, oh, you know, you just think, I can't bear this. So it will not see the light of day.
Do you think that you got anything out of that experience that's been helpful?
Oh, totally. I think it was like, it was fantastic because she was just so, she was so kind about it, but she was completely direct. And it was that thing of, I never thought, I remember Jessie Burton once saying that she deleted, I think 60,000 words of something that hadn't worked. And I was thinking, wow, she is rigorous. That's incredible. I would never do that. You know, I might edit it down a bit, but I'm keeping that because that's 60,000 words. And like words are precious when you're trying to write a book, you know, that your word count is like your God. And then I had to delete 130,000 words. And at the time, I remember thinking, Jesus Christ, you know, what the hell have I done? This is never going to happen. But then, and then it came together, and then I understood what the book was supposed to be. And I remember getting really buzzy and having ideas at night thinking, oh my God, this is how it's supposed to be.
Oh God, what a relief.
Yeah. And then it, and then I wrote it much, much faster than I'd written the first draft anyway. So it did work out. It meant that I did lose all my confidence, like all my confidence. Oh. I was just like, oh right, there is a dog. For the benefit of the tape, apologies. There is a dog sort of slumping around. It's a very hot day. He's lying under the table. This is very unprofessional of me.
No,
and
it's
I have apologized.
It's lovely.
it's colour for the listeners. So I lost all my confidence and felt like, and only recently sort of started thinking, maybe it'll be all right, because I couldn't tell. But I think, like, not being precious about it is good. And I'm not writing Shakespeare. So, you know, it's not like I'm killing my darlings. It's not like, you know, oh God, you know, this is art. You know, I think it's good to learn to just be ruthless and cut and just get rid.
So that 130,000 words that is dead, did it bear some relation to What a Way to Go? Did it have some of the same characters and plot points, or is this a completely different novel?
They're sort of bastardized versions, some of them. Okay. There's a couple of characters in there that are bastardized versions of the characters that I'd written about in the first book. It's almost like if you wrote a kind of comic version of something sad, you know, so you know, something, I'm trying to think of an example of something that's been a tragedy and then that's been made into a comedy. It's kind of, you know, it that would be what it's like if there is such a thing. Of course there is. Why can't I think of an example?
I can't think of one either.
I know. I keep thinking of like the modern versions of Shakespeare, but anyway. So there are a couple of people who have kernels that started with the first one, but they've turned funny. And in the first book, they were all sad and haunted and sort of chain smoking and, you know, regretting things and looking wistfully off into the distance and having, you know, flashbacks to things. And they're not doing that now.
Do you think funny is your comfort? I mean, not maybe comfort zone isn't the right thing, but do you think your voice is innately funny and that you would stick with being funny from now on? Or do you just think, you know, maybe another time we'll try serious?
Imagine I said, I think my voice is just innately funny. I just think that's who I am.
But it is, you are funny.
I mean, I just think the best books for me are the ones this is not true of all books, but this is the kind of, if I'm going on holiday, I want to read a book that captivates me entirely and that I'm not feeling like I have to work at, right? And there are books that you have to work at, and those books are fantastic, sometimes better. And for me, there's a time and a place for those books, and it's kind of something where you're ready to turn your brain on and work hard. And so I was trying to write the book that I wanted to read on holiday, which is, I hope, not kind of just a straightforward, you know, whodunit, whatever. That's not what I wanted. I wanted something that you could laugh about. And for me also, I'm always going to try and revert to the funny, always. You know, there's never going to be anything that I'm going to try and take seriously in my own life or anyone else's lives. Everything is about finding the funny or for the story. And so... that's my way of coping with everything in life. So it would be weird if I hadn't tried to write something funny too.
Yeah.
I mean, you write it and you don't know if it's funny. Do you know what I mean? You're writing it thinking, oh, I think this is funny, but you have no idea if someone else will. But I'm sure at some point I will try and do something that's not just for the jokes. I'm sure. But I think I'll find that really hard because every time I write a line, I'm like, oh, there's an opportunity for something, you know.
Who's your first reader?
My mum.
Okay.
Yeah, always my mum. Mainly because she's a really solid editor. She's not, she never just gets back and says, oh, darling, it's wonderful. You know, with the first draft, she didn't like it and she was like, not working. She's just a really good editor and she's very honest. And then my sister is the second one and she's even more honest, and like to the point of rudeness. And she will just send back notes that say things like, you know, why are you so obsessed with kind of, you know, the first person wistful nostalgia? She's like, oh, it was 1941 and, you know, I was driving a carriage through the blah. And she's like, what are you doing? Just tell us what's happening. So she's like, we need more fucking story and less of this blah, blah, blah. So those two are really great. Greg never reads them until they're finished. So yeah, it's mainly just my mum and my sister. No one else really reads it until the editor's done with it.
Yeah.
Not because I'm being precious about it. It's not like, you know, you can't read this. It's just, I think there's a weird thing about authors where they expect everyone in their lives to read their books. Whereas if you were a doctor or, you know, literally any other kind of job, your friends don't ask
come
you
to
a
work
single
and
thing. Yeah, and they're not asking
doing.
A single thing about your day. Whereas if you're a journalist or a writer or, I don't know, anything creative, you're sort of, you expect everyone to kind of be really invested in your career. And so when people, you know, have clearly not read something you've written, you're like, why haven't you?
What have you been doing? You?
Yeah, my uncle said to me at my parents' wedding anniversary, he was like, congratulations on the book, I've not read it. And I was like, okay, good. You didn't need to say it. You could have just said congratulations, but fine, thank you very much. So yeah, I think it's good to remind yourself something that, like, if you're asking people to read your book, you're asking them to kind of work.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, you're giving, like, them homework.
Yeah, basically. I'm like, I'm asking them to make notes. You know, that's quite a lot to ask. So yeah, I don't push it on people.
No. You said they're not, you know, you don't want it just to be a sort of whodunit, but they are kind of comic whodunits, kind of comic satirical whodunits. And or I would say, well, the first one's more of like a howdunit, and then the second one's a whodunit. What does
so
that?
So the third one has to be a whydunit.
Yeah, exactly. And then a whodunit.
Yeah.
So what does that require from you in terms of structure? To because it's that constant like building of suspense, isn't it?
So that's the thing that I'm really poor at, which I realized this time around, because the first book I had a structure, which was, you know, it's quite easy if you just kill, your structure is just death, you know, that's a very good structure. This one I didn't, because I didn't plot, like I say, because I just think, oh, I'll jump straight in and then it will all just come out of my mouth and onto the page or whatever, out of my brain. And I just got bogged down in getting to, you know, a problem and then thinking, okay, I'll rewrite my way out of this. And then 30,000 words later, you know, you're sort of back to where you were and you get bogged down and bogged down and bogged down. And so my editor's editor, and I'm only giving her the praise because my editor was on maternity leave, but my editor's editor said to me, when she left the company, actually, her parting thing to me was, structure is the most important thing. She was like, you can do character. Structure is the thing that you are lacking to make your characters kind of fly. And she said, just pick a structure. It can be any structure you like, you know, whatever you want. She said, David Nicol with One Day, that's the kind of perfect structure because it's one day every year. You know, it's such a simple thing. She was like, don't overthink the structure. Just pick something. Because without that, your characters are flabbing around and you're not building the suspense and you're not, you know, you're not doing all the things that you want to get to. You're overwriting your way out of a problem. And that was just really, really helpful for me because that is what I was doing. It's just, and it was really difficult sometimes for me to figure out how to get to the next step in the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I was just free floating in the air being like, well, it'll come to me in some way. So it was difficult. And I think it took a lot more work and writing than it needed to. And next time I feel like I'm going to know that now. So it was very trial and error and I hope it's worked, but you know, it's probably not as kind of considered as it should be about kind of pacing and tension. There are probably still bits in this book that are maybe too long or too short. And that's because she didn't tell me that until after I'd written it. She should have told me before.
But also the second book is told from multiple perspectives, whereas the first book is mainly told from one narrator. I mean, I have heard that that makes it a lot harder to write something when you're jumping between perspectives, although that doesn't come across in the reading of the novel.
I was trying to do something different because I knew that thematically they'd be similar, but I thought, you know, you've got to push yourself out of your comfort zone a bit, and actually to write in the first person the whole way through just for with one character, I thought it's too much like Grace. And actually Grace is such an easy character for me to write that I was worried I would slip into her too much, especially since I was also writing about other sort of psychopaths, you know. So I thought a couple of characters, a couple of perspectives would be better, more interesting, a bit challenging, and also to write more dialogue, which I didn't do any of in book one. And again, my sister was like, there's literally no dialogue. She was like, write one line of dialogue. And I was like, I can't, it makes me feel gross. Like, it gives me like the cringe that like it looks so artificial on the page. So I've tried to push myself with dialogue in this book because I still find it really difficult to do. And I, you know, otherwise I think if I'd written another just one person book, I'd have avoided all the dialogue again. So I had to try something different. But I think it was easy because I like all the voices. Actually, I care less about the armchair detective. I mean, she was interesting from the plot perspective, but to write, she was less interesting than the kind of terrible people.
Yeah.
So, but I liked being in there. I always like being in the horrible person's brain.
That's where I like to live. You do it so well.
Yeah, but it doesn't say good things, does it? That I'm like, I'm just very happy in these people's imaginations. This is where I want to be.
You said that you're plotting the third one. Mm. So what does plotting involve for you now? Are you making, you know, flow charts or spreadsheets, or is it just...
Well, you know, sometimes you see authors, especially on Instagram, they put up, you know, these pictures of their desks and their, you know, and they literally do almost have kind of yellow string going from X to Y to Z, you know, and you think, and I always get so intimidated. I think, oh my God, you know, that's what a proper writer does. And my urge is just to kind of go, well, I know the characters, they're in my head, I'm just going to just get it down. So this time I'm not doing string across, you know, pieces of paper. It's not that forensic. It's more like I've written down a structure sort of chapter by chapter, what will happen or what I hope will happen. And I've written out the structure in terms of like what is the chronological setting that's going with these characters, because it's a little bit for me like eating my vegetables before I have ice cream, which is I have to do that bit before I can dive into the people who I want. That's what I want to be doing, is the people. But I, you know, if it's just the people, then I genuinely think my sister's right, and I would just end up writing a book which was just kind of three people in a room talking to each other about, you know, their memories of the war or something. So I do need to eat my vegetables effectively.
So it's the characters that are the joyful part of it for you. Yeah. Do you think fondly on Grace from How to Kill Your Family? Do you feel like you'd like to revisit her?
I do, and I would. I mean, I find her slightly intimidating. You know, you think...
I mean, obviously she's a mass murderer, so...
It's not that so much. I'm not so fussed about the fact that she's killed people. I just think she'd judge me for a lot. You know, she'd be like, oh, she's so basic. You know, she'd just be like, oh, look at her basic house and her basic dog. And like, you know, she thinks she's so cool because she's married to a DJ. But, you know, all of those things. I can think of all the awful things she'd think about me. But I would like to revisit her. I just don't know when the right time would be for that, because... It's a little bit like, I thought book two, then you're just stuck in Grace world. You know, you're not doing anything new with your voice or her voice. You're just doing the same thing, kind of playing it safe. So I wanted to try something else. But then if I did it for the next book, then it's sort of, maybe it's too soon. But then if I leave it 10 years, maybe everyone will be like, sorry, who do you think you are? Like George R.R. Martin, like trying to bring the gang back together when like everything's done. So it's difficult, but I definitely don't feel like I've left her in the past entirely.
Yeah. What are you striving for in your writing?
Mainly, I want people to laugh, which is such a kind of weird thing to say, isn't it? Because like, you can't say you're funny in real life. You can't be like, well, the thing about me is I'm just a very funny person. So it's quite an odd thing to say that you want to make people laugh. But I do want to make people laugh. And I want people to like come back from reading that book and feel like it was a really fun, riotous read. I'm not trying to make windows into men's souls. You know, I'm not trying to kind of, you know, get people emotional, or, you know, there are books, you know, when you have a book hangover from an emotion, a really strong emotion, I want people to enjoy it. I want people to like it. I want people to, remember why they like reading. You know, that feeling of you put something down, then you immediately want to read something else. That's the feeling I want people to have when they read my books. Obviously, it won't always succeed, but that's always what I have in mind, is like, is this funny? Will someone enjoy it? Is this ridiculous? Is someone going to roll their head with laughter? Or, you know, or are they going to think this is tiresome and boring? You know, so it's that's what I'm trying to do, is find the funny and entertain people.
You said that you find dialogue quite difficult. Is there anything else that you find particularly challenging in writing?
I mean, all of it. I find all of it challenging, except character.
Well, obviously.
Yeah, dialogue for me is probably... I mean, I feel like I've slightly gotten over that hump with this book. I find it very difficult to write sort of concisely and, you know, stick to a word count. I always overwrite. That's just my... When I'm feeling insecure about a part of a book, I will overwrite instead of rereading, editing, thinking about it. I'll just kind of try and write through it, which means that this book ended up being 145,000 words, and I had to cut 40,000 words because that was just, it was obscene. Like, it didn't need to be that long, but that was my insecurity and because I'm a novice still, really. You know, I'm not someone who understands intrinsically how to write books, you know, so I still feel like a beginner.
I don't think anybody understands how to write books until, well, I think you just find out from writing books.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. I guess I just think about people who've done, like, you know, English literature masters, or, you know, people that have done, you know, writing classes, or, you know, I always just imagine that there are people really putting the work into those kind of forensic things, whereas I've just sort of gone, oh, I'll just try this out, you know. So, but, you know, I think writing short is much harder and more of a talent in many ways than writing long.
How did you go about cutting those 40,000 words from the manuscript? What was that process?
It was sitting down, going chronologically through it, thinking... It was easy, actually. I mean, it wasn't hard because, as I say, it wasn't like I wasn't ripping out plot points. I wasn't having to remember, oh, God, if I take this out, then it's not going to make sense. Because it was extraneous words. It was... you know, filler. I mean, it was, for me, what I thought was funny filler, but it was still filler, and it was indulgent, effectively, to have that many words when you didn't need them to, you know, to all be in there. And it's, I think it's the same with How to Kill Your Family. It was too long. The chapters specifically are too long. And I could have said less and got to the same place. And so that's something I'm trying to work on, which is just trying to get to the same place without sort of, you know, word diarrhea. So my next book, this book was 105, and I'm hoping my next book will be about 95, maybe even 90.
Have you ever had any kind of breakthrough moment that has really improved your writing, or something where you've just thought, oh God, I don't have to do it that way, I can do it this way?
I mean, I think for me, the thing that really helped me was realizing that I'm creating my worlds, you know, that I don't have to conform to someone else's world. So if I want something to happen in my world, then it will happen. And that, for a long time, I was thinking, well, is this realistic, or is this accurate, or does this chime with, you know, what people might expect? And actually, so for me, with this book, there was a real freedom in one of the characters is speaking from the afterlife. And at the time, I wanted him to stay in the book, but he was going to die very early. So I thought, how am I going to do that? Do I do flashbacks? How am I going to seed him in? And then I thought, well, maybe he's dead, and maybe he's watching everyone. And then I thought, you can't do that. That's a sci-fi book, or that's something else. That's a different genre. And then I thought, well, what genre am I? You know, if I want him to die and speak from heaven, then that's fine. And then I thought, well, what is heaven? And then obviously I came up with my own version of heaven. That was for me really freeing, because I realized that I can be a bit bolder about what I want to write, and how I want to write it. And I don't need to conform to a genre, because I think I really worried with How to Kill Your Family, what genre was it? You know, I never knew where to look for it in a bookshop, because it's not crime fiction. It's not humour, it's not a manual, though that is obviously...
But it's all of those things.
Right, but where do you put it, you know?
Yeah.
So I felt really kind of insecure about that for a long time, about what kind of book do I say that I write? But maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Is it something that comes up in the publishing industry that people want to know what genre this is? Or?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I think it was the same with Jog On, which was that, you know, instead of it ever being in the mental health section... or the sports section, it would be like somewhere completely random. And I would always be thinking, I don't understand why it's in philosophy, or, you know, it's in like world geography. It was always somewhere different. And publishers really like to know, you know, what your genre is. So that you can do that thing where you say, I'm number four on Amazon's list of the best books about gardening. You know, it's like the niche thing, because they need to have those kind of subcategories. I think it's just difficult because otherwise, you know, if you say I'm a crime writer, you know, everyone knows what you write. If you say I write about crimes, but they're funny, you know, what is that? Humorous crime? I don't know if there's a genre. There's cozy crime, but I don't think that's mine. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll have to start a genre.
It's not cozy.
It's not cozy.
It's more like sort of acerbic crime, sarcastic crime.
Sarcastic crime. There you go.
What do you feel proudest of when you think about your writing life to this point?
I think just that I've managed to write books. And I don't mean manage like in the sense of, you know, well done me for working so hard and being able to have the opportunity to write a book. I mean just literally writing the book. I think the idea, you know, since school, I haven't written more than 2,000 words, you know, ever. So the idea that I could write, you know, 100,000 words, 130,000 words, and that people would like it is astonishing to me. I mean, that's just, you know, for someone that loved English so much as a kid and as a teenager and as a young, the idea that I got to write books is just, on its own, will never not be like the coolest thing that I've ever done. Yeah.
Thank you so much to Bella Mackey. Her new novel is What a Way to Go. I'll link in the show notes to all of her books so that you can browse. If you came direct to this episode because you like Bella, then there are tons of other novelists in the archive, so do have a look. If you liked it, please share it on social media, that would be wonderful, or send it on to somebody else who might enjoy it. My book, In Writing, Conversations on Inspiration, Perspiration and Creative Desperation, is out next month. It features 55 interviews with writers of all kinds, including some who haven't been on the podcast, like David Sedaris, and some who have and have been favourites on the podcast, like Maggie O'Farrell and George Saunders, but who gave me new exclusive interviews delving deeper into their feelings about writing. You can pre-order it now via the link in the show notes, or even better, you can pop into your local bookshop and ask them to order it in for you. I'm going to be at Stratford-upon-Avon Literary Festival next Saturday, having a lovely chat with the novelist Anna Metcalf, and if you'd like to come and see us, I'll add a link to that too. A reminder before we go that if you want to learn more about writing genre fiction, you can start today with Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. See you next Friday when I'll be back with another brilliant writer.